Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, we have three really riveting stories for you today. First, 6 years after Lewis and Clark began their journey to the Pacific Northwest, two leading figures on the East Coast collaborated with a vision of their own. With dreams of transforming the United States into a Pacific trading power and democracy, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson turned their sights to founding a West Coast colony akin to Jamestown. We'll learn more about the amazing true story of the Astor Expedition in just a moment with author and correspondent for Outside Magazine, Peter Stark. I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Stark to the show. He's an adventure and exploration writer. He's studied English and anthropology at Dartmouth College, took a master's in journalism from the University of Wisconsin, and headed off to the remote spots of the world, writing magazine articles and books. He's been a longtime correspondent for Outside Magazine, and his essays have also appeared in some of the finest magazines out there today, Smithsonian, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and many others. He is best known, or his best known book, I should say, is The Last Breath, Cautionary Tales from the Limits of Human Endurance, and that was translated into seven languages and became Amazon.com number one best sports outdoor book for 2001. And Peter Stark's new book is called Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. Peter Stark, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Vicki.
Well, this is such a fascinating story. I guess the first question I have for you is that how did you become, first of all, interested in it?
Well, it is a fascinating story, and it's really a largely forgotten story, even though when Washington Irving wrote the story in 1836, commissioned by John Jacob Astor, it was a bestseller of 1836. But it's been largely forgotten since then, which is one of the things that fascinated me about it. And I really randomly stumbled across it. I was my previous book was titled The Last Empty Places, and I was profiling four different really unpopulated areas of the country. And so I was out in your territory, not quite, or just short of your territory,
right,
out
right
there. I was in Eastern Oregon, and anybody who's been to Eastern Oregon knows it's really unpopulated. And I was driving down a long, lonely highway one night or one evening, and it was getting dark, and I was wondering where if I'd have to spend the night sleeping in the car in the ditch. And I came to a little town with a motel, and I spent the night. And the next morning, I woke up and I learned the name of the town was John Day, Oregon. And I started thinking, now, who is John Day? Mm. Why would you name a town after John Day? And I started doing some research, and it turned out John Day was one of these original, he was a member of this original Astor expedition, the overland part of the expedition. And he had been traumatized in various ways. He'd been starved. He'd been abandoned. He'd poisoned himself by eating the wrong kind of roots rather than the right kind that the Indians were eating. He'd been helped by the Indians. He'd been stripped naked and sent out into the wilderness by the Indians. He'd finally become so traumatized, he faced with having to go retrace his steps. He tried to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a crazy story of John Day. And that was just the tip of the iceberg of this big story of this John Jacob Astor story and Astorian and expeditions. And he was actually a minor character in all this, but I just got drawn into it.
It's amazing where those ideas for bigger stories start or bigger explorations start. So let's talk a little bit about John Astor, first of all, John Jacob Astor, because he was a penniless immigrant from Germany. He became a multimillionaire, had a vision for the West Coast, the wealth that he could develop out in Astoria. He teamed up with Jefferson, who had a vision for democracy. Talk to us a little bit about how those two came together.
Well, that, you know, as you say, that John Jacob Astor was a penniless or nearly penniless German immigrant who came from a town called Waldorf, Germany, and thus the name Waldorf Astoria Hotel, which
oh.
we all know.
I didn't know that. Okay.
I know. It's a surprise when you put the two together. And he arrived in the U.S. as a young man right after the Revolutionary War, had met a fur trader on the ship over to America who said you could make a lot of money in the fur trade. Astor was bringing with him some finely made musical instruments. He ended up setting up a shop in Manhattan, which was then a tiny little town, tiny little city at the tip of Manhattan Island, a shop that sold this bizarre combination of finely made European musical instruments and wild animal pelts from North America. And he eventually made a fortune in the fur trade, and he started looking west, and he worked with Canadian fur traders who were pushing out towards the Rocky Mountains. He realized, he saw early the potential of the Pacific Rim, of the whole West Coast. And previously, about 20 years previously, Captain James Cook expeditions had been through the West Coast and really charted the Pacific, the first European vessels to really chart that part of the Pacific. And Cook's men discovered that you could buy a sea otter for the equivalent of $1 on the Northwest Coast, what's now Vancouver Island, and sell that fur on the other side of the Pacific in China for the equivalent of $100.
Wow.
And so that started off this, you know, that incredible markup started off a kind of fur rush of various Yankee and British ships. Okay, you know, every one or two a year would land on the Northwest Coast and pick up sea otter furs and take them to China. Well, Astor had a much broader vision. He envisioned how he could essentially capture all the furs from Western North America, funnel them through a port at the mouth of the Columbia that he would found, the first American port, first American settlement on the West Coast, send those to China, sell them and buy Chinese silks, teas, porcelain, bring those back to London and New York, sell those at a huge markup. So he'd have a fleet of ships continuously circling the globe, making a huge profit at every stop. And he approached Thomas Jefferson in 1808 with this vision and actually wrote Jefferson a letter. And Jefferson invited him to the president's house in Washington. And Jefferson had just, you know, recently sent out Lewis and Clark. And Meriwether Lewis had come back from the West Coast after a long and difficult journey saying, well, there's no easy way to get there, but it would really be great if America had a seaport at the mouth of the Columbia. So together, Astor and Jefferson met at the president's house, and they fired themselves up on this vision of this sort of trans-global, trans-Pacific trade empire that would be based at the mouth of the Columbia. And Astor saw it as a commercial endeavor, whereas Jefferson was seeing it as planting the seeds of democracy on
right,
the West
no,
Coast.
Right, nobody really owned it, that anything out here then, right?
There was not in terms of white settlement. No, there was nothing. You had down in Mexico, you had the Spanish settlement. You know, the Spanish had been in what's now Mexico for 150 years, but they'd built settlements. But they were well south. They'd built missions just in the recent decades. They'd built a few missions up as far as San Francisco, and so there was a Spanish presence. You know, just barely along the coast as far as San Francisco. And then the Russians had just recently built some fur posts up in Alaska. So in what's now Sitka, Alaska, was the farthest south Russian post. So between San Francisco and Sitka, you know, that's probably 1,500, probably close to 2,000 miles of northwest coast, totally unclaimed. And it extended all the way to the crest of the Rocky Mountains. So that's enough, you know, think of how inland that is.
Yeah,
it's an area...
Yeah.
You know, about the size of Europe, where there were no settlements whatsoever, white settlements. So it was this huge chunk of you know, kind of no man's land. And of course, there were Native American tribes everywhere. It wasn't no man's land. It was no man's land in terms of white, you know, European powers. So Jefferson saw this had this idea of planting the seeds of a democracy on the West Coast, and that he actually saw it as a sister democracy to the United States, which at that point was, you know, basically totally crowded on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains. It was all along the East Coast, you know, a little bit in the Ohio Valley, but mm-hmm. not very mm-hmm. far. And Jefferson saw this democracy on the West Coast spreading across the continent and joining the democracy that already existed on the East Coast, and together they'd join. So that was his vision. So there was a commercial vision and a political democratic vision going right. on between the two men.
And they decided to send out two parties. They sent one overseas around the Cape Horn, which is always treacherous the best
right.
of times.
Yeah. And in this case, it was especially treacherous due to the personalities involved.
Yeah, a captain or a ship's captain, apparently, who just ruled by force.
By iron fist, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And then the Overland Party, which I found probably more fascinating because I've done some of the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Oh, have you? Oh, good.
Were the ones who they followed that trail until they got to a certain point, and they ran into some folks, and one of the guys had been scalped, and they decided to take a 1,000-mile detour because of that. Talk to us a little bit about that.
It's a fascinating story, and as I say, you know, I just channeled the story. They were existing out there
right.
this unknown story that, you know, largely unknown as the historians know about it. So Astor came up with this plan. He was a meticulous businessman, you know, really far-seeing, very conscientious, very bottom-line oriented. And so he came up with this plan to send a two-pronged expedition to establish this, you know, this Jamestown of the West Coast, this first American colony. One by sea and one overland. The Overland Party was led by a young New Jersey businessman named Wilson Price Hunt, who was, I think, 27 years old, and very conscientious guy, you know, serious-minded, very loyal to Astor, liked to lead by consensus. But his big drawback was he'd never been in the wilderness before, and he was supposed to lead a party across the North American continent, you know, the wilds of the Western.
I don't want to interrupt you, really, but that so surprised me because on both the overland and the sea voyage, they didn't really have any exploration experience between them.
Well, the leaders didn't, and that was a huge issue, and that's one of the things I write a lot about, is how there were these pivotal leadership decisions that would actually shape much of the North American continent in the hands of these leaders who were very different personalities and not necessarily qualified to make them.
Mm.
And I think the reason that Astor chose these, at least in the case of Wilson Price Hunt, the young New Jersey businessman, Astor knew that Hunt was an American and would be loyal to Astor for, you know, in whatever case. Whereas a number of the other members of that overland party that Hunt led were expert Scottish fur traders and French Canadian voyageurs mm-hmm. who were actually loyal to the British crown. And
right,
so
right.
That's why Astor chose Hunt to lead it. So as you were saying, that Hunt was supposed to follow the Lewis and Clark route with this huge expedition, you know, twice the size of Lewis and Clark, 60 people, you know, maybe 10 or 15 tons of gear, up the Missouri, following the Lewis and Clark route, which, as you know, goes up the Missouri, then over the Rocky Mountains, and then down the Columbia. And they got partway up the Missouri, and they started hearing more and more horror stories about the ferocity of the Blackfeet Indians at the headwaters of the Missouri. And one day met these three trappers coming down the river in canoes, one of whom had been scalped, and who said, "You really don't want to go up that way. You know, the Blackfeet are—they're really angry because Meriwether Lewis killed two of their young men and mm-hmm. left a Jefferson Presidential Medal hanging around one of their necks, and they're just don't go up there. But actually, we think we can lead you on a way that detours south of the Blackfeet." And the Hunt was in this dilemma whether to follow the known route into Blackfeet territory, the Lewis and Clark route, or to strike off, leave the Missouri, and to strike off into what was essentially 1,000 miles of more or more of completely uncharted terrain. And he made that decision after a lot of agonizing to go off into the uncharted terrain. And he found some really difficult going.
Yeah. In retrospect, I read in the epilogue that that was a good decision in retrospect because it found the best way through for future explorers. But they did not know that at the time.
They didn't know that. And it ended up, well, Hunt stumbled around and, you know, they almost all died because they, you know, they trekked 4 months across what's now the Dakotas and Wyoming and into Idaho and crossed the Tetons, and the three trappers said, well, here's a little river. We think this leads to the Columbia and to the Pacific coast. You can just build canoes here and paddle down. Hunt, you know, due to his lack of experience had been kind of dilly-dallying along and not really feeling the rush of time. He'd never been in winter in the mountains before. Mm. And I don't think he'd ever been in the mountains at all before. And so by the time they even built canoes on, you know, this is around where around Jackson Hole, Wyoming, just west of it, it was already late November, and they got in these canoes and started paddling down the river. You know, this huge party, 50 people, you know, 10 or 15 tons of gear, huge canoes, and the first day was great, you know, the river was fast, it was smooth, they made a lot of mileage, everybody's happy, the voyagers are singing. Second day, they hit a few riffles. Third day, they hit rapids, they swamp two canoes, lose a lot of the trade goods and food in one canoe. By the ninth day, they're going over major waterfalls, the canoes are smashing, the voyagers are drowning. They end up stuck in the Snake River Canyon in early November and running out of food. They have to go on foot now. They split up. To make a long story short, they end up stumbling into Hell's Canyon, which is the deepest canyon in all of North America.
Mm-hmm.
It's now on the Oregon-Idaho border. And it's winter, and they get caught in Hell's Canyon with no food, and people are starting to drop dead drop from exhaustion and starvation. And Hunt is now in this dilemma whether to stick with his dying friends beside the side of the trail or lead his expedition out of this canyon to try to find some Indian villages. And in this party is a woman who's like a Sacagawea character, but even more so, she has the wife of a Native American, wife of the interpreter, Marie Dorian, is her name, and she has two toddler boys, and she's also pregnant, and she's part of this party. And she holds up amazingly well through all this.
Yeah.
But through all that, all that stumbling around Hunt's route and the guys who came after him and went back the same way, they ended up discovering what became the Oregon Trail, the easiest route across that part of the Rocky Mountains where you could actually take a wagon through. So they found the way, basically, but yeah, they certainly suffered for it.
They did. They faced an incredible danger, violence, hunger. You say almost half of them died. Others went totally mad.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the madness that happened.
Well, for instance, John Day was one of the characters who was clearly suffering from PTSD. And he was, as I was saying earlier, he was the first character I came across in the story. He was part of that Hunt expedition, and he was one of the guys who was in Hell's Canyon in the winter, and he'd gone ahead with another group on an exploratory mission and come back to the main party. And by the time that he got back, he was so exhausted, they'd run out of food. You know, he was just dropping. Hunt ended up leaving him behind and another guy named a Scottish fur trader named Ramsey Crooks. Ramsey Crooks and John Day ended up having to fend for themselves all winter long, trying to get out of this total wilderness. You know, they were starving, then they poisoned themselves by eating the wrong roots, and then they lost the tracks that they were following through the snow. Then they finally reached what they thought was safety on the Columbia River, and they were met by some Indians. They'd been helped by previous Indians, but these Indians stripped them naked and told them to go back to, you know, go away and
right,
don't come back.
Right, right.
By that time, John Day was, he was about done with it. He was beyond done with it. He was finally rescued, and they made it to Astoria. The settlement had started by that time. The sea-going party had made it to the mouth of the Columbia and started the settlement. And John Day, these stragglers, made it 6 weeks later, they had to turn around and go back the same way to deliver messages to John Jacob Astor overland.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And, and John Day started, you know, they got a few days, well, you all know this geography. They paddled from the mouth of the Columbia, what's now Astoria, up as far as, right around the Portland area. And they got to an island right around Portland, what's now Portland. And, you know, from there you can see Mount Hood very mm-hmm, clearly. Mm-hmm. And there's, just reading the medical literature of PTSD, there's a well-known phenomenon called a triggering device or a trigger, that it can be a sight or a sound that triggers memories of a traumatic experience. Well, John Day got just about to that point where he could see Mount Hood, which is near where he'd been stripped by the Indians and sent back into the wilderness again. And he started just talking crazily, and, you know, he just sort of went mad, you know, other explorers write in their journals.
Understandably.
They were camped that night on, I think it was called, Strawberry Island, Strawberry Island, near what's now Portland. And in the middle of the night, or just before dawn, he pulled out two pistols and he put them to his head and he pulled the triggers.
Mm.
And he missed. I mean, I don't know how, but he did. And they had to kind of tie him in a canoe and put him offshore so he couldn't get into any more trouble. And they finally sent him back to the mouth of the Columbia.
Yeah.
There was another guy who had been abandoned a year or two earlier who these explorers found out in the wilderness wandering around, and he'd gone totally mad.
Yeah. Well, you can understand. I mean, it's bad enough traveling today, but traveling back then was a whole different thing. Peter, we're right at the end of our segment. We're going to have you back, because I didn't even get to a fraction of the questions I have for you.
Well, it's such a big story, and it's such an unknown story.
It is.
And it's actually a very historically significant story, which we didn't touch on that part. We're not even to the mouth of the Columbia yet.
No, I know. This is all in my notes. You're just going to have to come back, okay? The book is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. And my guest, of course, Peter Stock. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to animal communicator Darcy Pariso, we cover the world of animals. This week, August 31st, it's the last Sunday of the month, and that means it's a shelter, rescue, sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. Kathy and Christy will host a show for me. Together, they'll check in with our bird and horse rescue and sanctuary regulars. Plus, they'll have new stuff and great interviews. Join them for the fun. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I fight fires and I save lives.
My name's Renee. I'm a cardiologist. I save lives.
My name's Anthony. I'm an EMT. I save lives.
You don't have to be a professional to save a life. Firefighters, doctors, and others save lives. You can too. Don't wait. To learn more about the warning signs and how you can help prevent suicide, visit save.org. In a crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard-approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Remember, you're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. And I'm also pleased to welcome back today Peter Stark. We talked with him on April 15th. You can find out the first part of our discussion on podcast at conversationslive.net. And he's been a longtime correspondent for Outside Magazine. He's an adventure and exploration writer. His articles and essays have also appeared in Smithsonian, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Men's Journal, and many others. And Peter Stark's best-known book, Last Breath, Cautionary Tales from the Limits of Human Endurance, was translated into seven languages and named Amazon.com's number one sports outdoor book of 2001. And his new book is called Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, a story of wealth, ambition, and survival. And I asked Peter to come back and join us again to finish off the story, per se. There's so much to talk about in this book. It is so well written. It's so packed full of historical facts. But also, it's a great story. He really focuses on the people and their struggle for humanity during this journey. So, Peter Stark, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I'm so pleased to be here.
So let's just refresh here, because last time you were here, we discussed how 200 years ago, this story was very well known, but then became largely forgotten. So this is your book here is the first time that this pivotal moment in American history has been recreated. And we talked about why and how this journey began, some of the challenges the explorers faced, including madness. We hadn't even reached the mouth of the Columbia. So let's just do a quick recap, if you would, and then we'll jump into the second half.
Okay, a quick recap. So John Jacob Astor was a young German immigrant who came to New York City in the early or in the late 1700s, became a fur merchant, made a lot of money, had a vision of starting the first American colony on the West Coast. And this is at the same time Thomas Jefferson had just purchased the Louisiana Purchase and sent the Lewis and Clark Expedition to the mouth of the Columbia. So together, Astor and Jefferson came up with this great scheme to establish this first American colony on the West Coast. Astor had this huge commercial vision of taking trade goods from New York, sending them around South America to the mouth of the Columbia, trading them with the coastal Indians for sea otter furs, selling those in China where there were huge markups available, using those profits to load Chinese silks, teas, porcelains, Chinese luxury goods, taking those back around the world to London and New York, another huge markup. So Astor has a fleet of ships continuously circling the globe with huge profits at every stop. All centered on this colony on the West Coast. The West Coast at that time is impossibly remote and wild, although there were, of course, Indian tribes very well established there. Astor wanted to capture essentially all the wealth of the western part of North America and funnel it through his own hands. So he sent out in 1810 two advance parties, big expeditions. This was 5 years after Lewis and Clark, to establish this first American colony at the mouth of the Columbia. And one went by land, overland, up the Missouri, led by Wilson Price Hunt, a young New Jersey businessman who, one of his great drawbacks, he had many positive characteristics, but his great drawback was he'd never been in the wilderness before. Jonathan Thorne, a young U.S. naval hero, fearless in battle, but distinctly lacking in a personal touch, and had a shipload of, a shaggy lot of Scottish fur traders from Canada, and French Canadian voyageurs from Canada, and some seven or eight cheeky young Scottish educated clerks. And Captain Thorne was steeped in U.S. military discipline. So, of course, almost predictably, the first night out of New York Harbor, September 1810, Captain Thorne gave the order for lights out at 8 o'clock, and the fur traders are smoking their pipes on deck, and the voyageurs are, talking, and everybody's hanging out. And they say, "No, we're not ready for bed." And he says, "Yes, you are. The light's out." And they say, "No, we're not. In fact, John Jacob Astor has given us shares in this enterprise, so we, in fact, own part of the ship." And Captain Thorne turns to the Scottish fur traders and says, "The first man who disobeys my orders aboard my own ship, I'm going to blow his brains out." And relations deteriorate from that point on aboard the Tonquin, the ship. So they end up in, to follow the ship journey, they by the time they get to the Falkland Islands, which is off the tip of South America, this is the ship, this Tonquin. It's this beautiful ship. It's 100 feet long, 300 tons, state of the art, sheathed with copper, which means it's really fast, has 10 cannon, 8,000 pounds of gunpowder, all the supplies, the trade goods, the beads, the pots, the food that you need to start a colony. So it's just crammed with all this stuff, plus all these passengers, these shaggy passengers, plus a regular crew of Yankee sailors, 23 Yankee sailors. So by the time they get to the Falkland Islands, out of, this is some months out of New York Harbor, relations have deteriorated to the point where they put in for water at the Barren Falklands, and the Scottish fur traders, or five or six of them, go hunting with their shotguns for ducks and geese on the shore. While they're ashore, Captain Thorne sails away without them to abandon them on the Falklands. And he's sailed 6 miles out onto the open sea, and he's not turning back. They're madly rowing after him in a longboat.
Oh my God.
The only thing that saves them is that there's one nephew of the Scottish fur trader, still aboard ship, and he marches up to Captain Thorne on the deck and pulls out two pistols and puts them under Thorne's chin and says, "Either you turn this ship around or you're a dead man this instant." So he turns it around and picks them up.
Right. You said in the book that Astor picked Thorne because he was looking for the bravest man he could find. And you say there's a point when bravery shades into arrogance and arrogance shades into idiocy. And yet you also said you felt a certain sympathy for him.
I felt a certain sympathy for him in the sense that in terms of his human touch, it's very hard to feel any sympathy whatsoever. On the other hand, he was clever and fearless in battle, and he felt that was his charge. And so when at one point in the voyage through the South Atlantic, they're chased by his ship is chased by what appears to be a British ship that's trying to capture them, and he responds very nimbly and ably by pretending he's loading all his cannon to open fire, and this other ship shears away and takes off. But he's also, because he's surrounded by, he's been steeped in a military culture and he's never really been exposed to other cultures, and he finds himself in these situations, both aboard ship with the fur traders, and also when he finally gets to the West Coast among the coastal Indians, where he's confronted with very different cultures, and he doesn't know how to react. And my sense is that he retreats. I mean, he's fearful and actually nervous, and he retreats into this very strict, rigid discipline and kind of militaristic bearing, whereas, in fact, if he'd softened up and been more empathetic, he would have got a lot farther.
Right, and certainly if he hadn't, there's a story. I mean, when I was going back, Peter, reading my notes and refreshing myself on the book, I thought you couldn't make all of this up fiction book.
It's so bizarre. It's so wild.
There are so many stories. But
and that was the problem in writing the book, was that there's so many stories. Just to, you know, to keep moving it forward, there's so many side stories that are just wild and fascinating. But just to keep it moving forward with the great stories there are, that was a challenge on its own. But go ahead, I diverted you.
Yeah, I was. You talked about, you know, if he'd taken a more human approach, and I was thinking of the story where he was trying to buy the sea otter furs, and the Indian chief was charging too much, and so he rubbed the fur in the Indian chief's face, and with dire consequences.
With very dire consequences, yes. That he just had no touch with other humans, and so yes, the Indian chief, when they finally do arrive on the West Coast, Thorne drops the colony at the mouth of the Columbia, and then according to Astor's orders, Thorne sails on to Vancouver Island to trade for sea otter furs, which is where the richest sea otter furs are, and Thorne's first interaction with the coastal Indians there in Clayoquot Sound is when Indian elder comes on board, who's the chief bargainer, and yes, and as you say, charges too high a price in Thorne's mind. You know, Thorne's a very strict, straightforward Yankee man, and Thorne gets so angry he takes the sea otter fur and rubs it in the captain's face and throws him off the ship. And the advice from, there is one experienced fur trader aboard who says, you know, that was a really bad idea. We better leave now. And Thorne essentially, in effect, says, "Oh, what, you know, what can a bunch of the Indians here do against a ship like this, armed with 10 cannon and, you know, 8,000 pounds of gunpowder?" But they found a way, and it did not end well for Thorne at all.
It did not. It did not end well. So let's talk a little bit about when they first landed in Astoria and how things started to come together for them. Because, you know, Astor had this great big dream for this global triangle enterprise with China. Jefferson wanted democracy. So how did they, you know, when they first got there, how did they start putting this into practice?
Well, they arrived, you know, after this tumultuous voyage. The seagoing party arrived in March 1811 off the mouth of the Columbia. I'm sure many of your listeners know that geography off the mouth of the Columbia. To this day, it lies one of the most treacherous stretches of water in the entire world, the Columbia Bar. And Thorne was so eager to get going with his mission that he sent three separate longboats out into this incredible gale to try to find the channel through the Columbia Bar, even though his office were saying this is madness. He in effect, drowned nine men on the Columbia Bar trying to find the channel. Thorne did by pushing them out into the storm. And so finally they did get across. The Tonkin did get across into the mouth of the Columbia, found a suitable spot, which is now called Astoria, Oregon, landed the colony there. What they did is they, on the way to the West Coast, they stopped at Hawaii, and which is, it, you know, it doesn't make sense in our minds,
but right,
because we have, you know, fossil fuel powered ships.
Right,
they had
right.
Wind powered ships, and they were sailing with the trade winds and the various winds. That Hawaii was more or less on the way. You know, it was a tack out into the Pacific, and it was also a great source for fresh food and supplies. And plus Hawaiians, which is one of the really interesting facets of the story, is that Hawaiians played a big part in it, in the original settling of the Northwest.
Mm. Well, let's stop there. We have to take a quick break. So let's stop there, and then we'll find out how the Hawaiians played a part in there. Also, we have some questions around Astor and why he kept pushing this expedition.
Okay.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest is Peter Stark. His book is called Astoria, and it is a great adventure. It's a nonfiction book, but it really is filled with great adventure and a terrific story. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Still have our stories, battle scars, pirate ships, and wounds. Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Some people know a good thing when they hear it. Alternative Talk 1150 AM. I'm taking them all back.
And welcome back, everybody. We are talking in this segment with Peter Stark, talking about his new book, Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Lost Pacific Empire, A Story of Wealth, Ambition and Survival. And I find it such a fascinating story, as I know many of you did, that I asked Peter to come back and continue the journey with us. Such adventures in this book and such hardships shared. And Peter, I wanted to, you were talking before we went to break about how the Hawaiians had a huge influence on the starting of Astoria. So tell us about that.
Yes, it's really a very little known aspect of Western history. So ships like the Tonquin, one of the first, because it was starting the first colony on the West Coast, put into Hawaii and loaded fresh fruit and vegetables, 100 live Hawaiian pigs, and this is on a 100-foot-long boat. You can imagine what that deck looked like. then they had, they hired 24 Hawaiian, they called them boatmen, Hawaiian boatmen, because the Hawaiians were very good in canoes. They were incredible swimmers. They knew how to grow gardens. They knew how to tend pigs. They knew how to start a colony, basically. And so they, the Tonquin under Thorne took these 24 Hawaiians and all these live pigs. Finally, they made it across the Columbia Bar to the mouth of the Columbia and unloaded the voyageurs, the Scottish fur traders, the pigs, the Hawaiians, and they started a colony. They laid started a very substantial warehouse. It was their first building. And they, when they laid the cornerstone of the warehouse, they said, what are we going to call this? And somebody said, well, let's call it Astoria. So that's how that came to be. And, you know, if things had gone differently, the entire West Coast today might be known as Astoria, and it might be a separate country that called Astoria, but it didn't go that way. So the Hawaiians were there. They were growing gardens. They were raising pigs. The French-Canadian voyageurs and the Scottish fur traders started up the Columbia River and its various branches to establish fur posts all through the Columbia Basin, which, you know, as you know, it's a very large basin, and it was very, very rich in furs. And actually, one of the curious parts of this is I'm talking to you because you're based in the Puget Sound area,
right?
Because the Puget Sound area did not figure into this because it was such a river oriented trade, you know, that they were using the river as a highway,
right?
To get way, but they could get way up into the mountains, into the interior, you know, the area the size of France, I think, is the Columbia Basin. And just to finish the Hawaiian story is that way in eastern Oregon today, there's a river called the Owyhee River and a desert called the Owyhee Desert in eastern Oregon.
Oh,
and that
okay.
got its name from three Hawaiians, this is at least the story, who died of thirst in this desert in these very early fur trading days, because Hawaii was called Owyhee. People were known as Owyhees.
Right, right.
And so that's how the desert got its name.
Oh, interesting. So they had some success there. The trading went well for a little while, but it never really became successful. It never became the democracy Jefferson was looking for, or the business empire that Astor was looking for. And I have some questions around Astor, because he wasn't a gambling man. You talk in the book how he didn't play cards for money. He abhorred the speculative nature of the stock market. And yet here he is gambling with vast amounts of money, but not just that, human life. Half of those guys who went out ended in violent death.
Exactly. And it's a real paradox about Astor that he abhorred the gambling, the speculation in stocks, which was then just starting in New York. The New York Stock Exchange, just when he arrived in New York, was just getting going, and he abhorred that notion, that kind of gambling. Yet he, as you say, gambled on a vastly larger scale with a whole chunk of the North American continent, with all these lives, and with vast amounts of money of his own. And he's a paradoxical personality that way. You know, he was a very a domestic minded kind of guy. He was a real family man. He loved his family. You know, he lived on Broadway in New York and in a fairly modest house, but had a very staid family life. And yet he'd also had some experience in the wilderness himself as a young fur trader. So he had to know some of the things that these guys were going through. But I think even Astor, for all his broad vision, and I think even Thomas Jefferson, for his broad vision, although he wasn't involved in any way in the day-to-day management of this huge scheme, but I think neither of them, and Astor especially, didn't realize the vastness of the continent and the incredible difficulties that these guys would face, that his men would face, and the remoteness, and also I think no one, unless they've been in that situation, I mean, Astor, Jefferson, or anyone who's never been in that situation, understands the psychological pressures on the people who are in that situation. Incredible isolation, you know, possible hostile Indians around you. You have no idea where you are. You don't know if you're going to survive. You're years away from getting back to what you know, to, you know, your version of civilization. And you're in these situations where you're having to make very difficult decisions about whether to take, you know, two steps forward or one step sideways, or what, right. You know, what are we going to do from here? And that's right. That's the story that fascinates me, is how these guys, these leaders, react under that kind of pressure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, we're right at the end of our segment. Boy, that flew by.
Oh, already?
But, you know, no doubt had they succeeded, and Hiram Chittenden, who we're familiar with up here because we have the Locks named that after him.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. He wrote that the course of the empire on the American continent would have been altogether different than it has been. There basically would have been no Vancouver. Everything from Alaska down to Mexico would have been American. So very significant. It could have had a very significant impact. So we've got about 30 seconds here. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Peter?
Well, I'll try to make it two really final thoughts. That one, I think the Pacific would have been a global center way earlier than it became. That it's, you know, really coming into prominence today, had Astor succeeded. And the other is that's amazing to me how the course of empire and geopolitics can turn on individual personalities the way it did in this case, and individual leadership skills, which the whole, you know, a bunch of the continent was hanging in the balance on these guys' personalities.
Right, right. And let's tell listeners where they can find your website. It's peterstark.com, is it?
It's peterstarkauthor.com.
peterstarkauthor.com. And the book, again, is Astoria, John Jacob Astor and Thomas Jefferson's Last Pacific Empire, A Story of Wealth, Ambition, and Survival. It really is a great read and beautifully written and full of adventures that we couldn't make up, right, Peter?
We couldn't make them up.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for coming back again to finish the story.
Thank you, Vicky. I really so much enjoy it.
And we have to leave you right now, so we will be back next week. You can find me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or at info@conversationslive.net. You can also find us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and Facebook, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. If you missed any of today's show or have comments or feedback, I'd love to hear from you. And I want to thank you for spending this hour with us. And we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.